It's Wednesday, February the 8th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. For some months now, the Irish Times has been publishing the findings of North and South, the series which we've been running in association with ARINS, that's Analysing and Researching Ireland North and South, which is a joint research project of the Royal Irish Academy and the Keogh Nocton Centre for Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame, or Notre Dame, if you prefer, or Notre Dame even. The series is now concluded, but we wanted to take the opportunity to look back at its findings and discuss what they might mean for future political and constitutional developments on this island. And to do that, we are joined again by the project leader, John Garry, Professor of Political Behaviour at Queen's University in Belfast, and the co-leader, Brendan O'Leary, Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, along with our political editor, Pat Leahy. Gentlemen, hello to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I suppose the question is where to start. I'm not going to ask anybody to summarise the whole project because it really was enormous. But John, if I could go to you first, because the most recent tranche, the final set of data published by the Irish Times about a week and a bit ago, was about an interesting subject, which was, I suppose, really is about people's heads as much as lines on a map. It was about the two political entities in this island, the people who live in them, what they think of each other, and maybe even how well they know each other.
Yeah, I think this was a particularly interesting batch of questions because we could figure out how many people, for example, in the South had friends in the North, or how many people in the North had friends in the South. So we were really trying to get at how connected the actual people were across the border. We asked about friends, relations. We asked people how often they travelled to the South. We asked about whether they went for a day trip or whether they stayed overnight. And the findings were very interesting. Then people in the North are more connected to people in the South than people in the South are connected to the North. And there's also an interesting kind of geographical twist, which perhaps on reflection isn't terribly surprising, but it's quite noteworthy. For people who live in Munster, it looks like they've never even heard of Northern Ireland. It could be in planet Neptune for all they know. They've no friends there. They've no relations there. They never go there. They don't seem to know anything about it. Whereas people in quite proximate to the border in Connacht, Ulster, are much more connected to people in the North than people further away in Munster.
And one of the things I found interesting about the poll, and this is one of the great things about us publishing it in the Irish Times, Pat, I think, is the reaction to it. And some people pushed back against some of the findings of the poll, or at least questioned them. The poll does show, actually, it should be said, that there are different lines of communication, as one would expect, as John says, between people who live, for example, in the northern half of the Republic of Ireland with the North, as opposed to people like yourself from Munster, who really seem terribly ignorant of Northern Ireland. A couple of people have written...
Of many things, really, but
Well, you just added to the long list. But, a couple of people have written about this, including Mary Minahan, our features editor, who's from Derry, and about the kind of very close relationships that exist between Derry and, essentially, its hinterland in Donegal. And I suppose the questions I was wondering is, some people have said to me about these results, well, they're not very surprising, are they? For example, the fact that people in the North have slightly more connection with the South is kind of a function of the way gravity works in demographics. It's the same way as because Scotland is smaller than England, more Scottish people have been to England proportionately than vice versa. Is that not the way it works, that kind of a centrifugal force?
Yeah, I guess that's happening to an extent as well. I suppose another weakness in the question, if we're being self-critical about it, is that it necessarily lacks a comparative framework. So it'll be really interesting to know what those statistics were in, say, 1970, or what they were in 1920. But we don't have that information, obviously. So all we can do is put out the information that we had. As to whether people were surprised by it or not, that's up to them. I was surprised, to be honest, at the level of separation between the two societies on a personal level. When we talk about friends and relations, for instance, I would imagine if you polled people in the Republic and asked them, did they have relations in Great Britain or relations in the United States, that much higher proportions of them would answer that they did. So I think it is of a piece. I think that particular finding, and I suppose we often say it's important to realize as much what polls don't tell you as much as what they tell you. But I think that that finding was of a piece with a broader, you know, the broader thrust of the of many of the responses to the poll, or much of the data in it, which did underline this kind of a broad level. You used the term ignorance earlier, Hugh, in relation to people from Munster. I used the term in its literal sense, you know, in that like lots of people in the South simply don't know much about the North. And not alone do they not know much about the North, they don't appear all that interested in finding out about it, even when they are addressing the topical issue of how a united Ireland might work. And, you know, many of them are of the view that, you know, well, you know, people in the North will just have to get used to us. We're not really willing to make any changes to accommodate them in a united Ireland. So I suppose the degree of separation that we that those particular questions demonstrated is of a piece with that.
Yeah, I should point out that when I was writing about this, no disrespect to Pat, who is from Munster, that I pointed out I have no friends in Munster. So in theory,
this isn't surprising, really, considering, you know,
no friends at all.
Your attitudes.
I must emphasise that a Munster-born person is here myself, and I'm also a County Antrim person. So it is possible to have connectivity. You haven't increased your friendship, Hugh, by saying that, your friendship members. Geography does matter, and our data is not finally available at a district level. So I would predict that if we had even more data, we would probably have many more connections between Louth and the North. And I think our data is sufficient to show that the Dublin-Belfast corridor is significant. It would be very interesting to see what County Antrim is in relationship to other counties, so that we would have a sense of what you would predict purely on geographical knowledge alone, and what is a result of the estrangement caused by partition. So although I don't think the results are surprising, I don't think they should be over-exaggerated either.
Is there something else that we might try and measure perhaps in the future, Brendan? I was thinking about this, and along with proximity, friendship, family ties, I mean, so much of our life is, particularly these days, is spent in a different sphere, which is the sphere of media, entertainment, culture, what some writers and philosophers in the past in Ireland sometimes have called the fifth province, which might be a useful way of thinking about new ways of thinking about the entire island of Ireland. And it seems to me that, you know, some of the divisions among the divisions between North and South are that we do or have, to quite a large extent, lived in quite separate worlds at times with those, the newspapers we read, the radio programs we listen to, the TV we watch.
I agree, Hugh. And with both BBC and RTE, there may be legal reasons that I don't know about in any depth, which explain why there are, in effect, media silos. It used to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get RTE inside Northern Ireland. And it was rare in some parts of the Republic to get access to RTE. And that matters for comparative purposes. Ireland, the Republic, tends to compare itself to the rest of the world, including the UK as a whole. Whereas in Northern Ireland, BBC Northern Ireland is very parochial and always compares, in my experience, Northern Ireland with other parts of the UK rather than with the Republic. And that would account, to my mind, for the shocking levels of ignorance in the North about the comparative economic performance of the Republic, the comparatively better performance of the Southern Health Service by comparison with the NHS, and on a whole range of other matters. So that's an area where North-South connectivity, I think, can and should be improved. The question of newspapers, of course, is much more difficult to interpret as a result of blocked legal regulation. You can buy any Irish newspaper, though the Irish Times does tend to be more difficult to get physically outside of significant urban locations, but it is available on the web and it does have northern subscribers. But that continuing divergence in newspapers on the web, I think, will keep people apart.
And finally, on this particular first point, John, if I could ask you, the other development which must have had an impact on these cross-border relationships, along with the end of the Troubles, obviously, which is a major factor, and the arrival of the EU. But is the change in the relative economic power of the two jurisdictions? That's, you know, if somebody was coming in a time machine from 1920, I think that's what they would notice, that the economic industrial powerhouse was in the northeast of the island at that time, and that is no longer the case. If there is such a powerhouse, it's along the eastern seaboard of the Republic.
Yeah, I mean, apparently the Republic of Ireland is very rich and Northern Ireland isn't so rich. That seems to summarise matters. Although, anecdotally, rather than data-orientedly, if you're living in Northern Ireland, it often feels like it's cheaper and easier to live in Northern Ireland than it does in Dublin, for example, where people might get paid a multiple. As Brendan alluded to earlier, what's kind of important with respect to these polls and tapping people's knowledge north and south is to get to a stage where people have a pretty accurate understanding of certain things, whether it's health or economics. Because I think you're right in your question by implying that one of the reasons that people, maybe a lot of people in the North, didn't want to link up with the South is they thought it was much poorer and not very liberal. And now the world seems to have changed, and Ireland's not only richer, but it's quite a deal more liberal. And I think both of these things to an extent came out in our survey, and the more people kind of understand and appreciate them, we think that might have an effect, the more they think about them, on overall attitudes to the South from the North, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's very true. We're going to move on to, we got a number of questions in from listeners, so thank you for those. The first one comes from Niall Daly.
Hi there, politics team. My question concerns a sentiment that is increasingly heard from some quarters, namely that a 50% plus one majority would not be sufficient for a unification in practical terms. This is a hard sell to nationalists, particularly those in the North, who voted for the Good Friday Agreement on the basis that a simple majority in referendums either side of the border would be sufficient for reunification, not that it would require some kind of qualified majority with an implied unionist veto. Do you agree that stipulating that reunification should not happen until an arbitrary percentage of unionists are content legitimises a hypothetical threat of loyalist violence and encourages voters north and south to accept democracy potentially being subverted by threats of violence? Thank you.
Brendan, there's quite a lot in that.
Right. Let me set aside the question of pandering. It's clear in the Good Friday Agreement, six times in the text, that a simple majority in the North is sufficient for Irish reunification. And that is matched in the South by the reference to democratic support. If that provision had not been in the Good Friday Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement would not have had sufficient support in the North to pass to the extent that it did. So it would be unreasonable and unjust, in my view, to shift the goalposts. It would be unjust because it would mean that in weighing votes, pro-union votes would weigh more than pro-reunification votes, and that can't be right. It's also been constant UK policy since the formation of Northern Ireland to say that its existence as part of the United Kingdom rests on the will of a majority, first decided by its parliament and then decided by its people. If we look at UK practice on referendums, the Welsh National Assembly came into being on a 50.5% vote on a 50% turnout. If we look at Brexit, quotation marks, that went ahead on the basis of 52% to 48%. So any change in the rule for Northern Ireland would, I think, be regarded as deeply unjust and would be deeply destabilising. International practice in this area is very clear. Self-determination, in most cases, takes place on the basis of a simple majority in the relevant defined unit. Now, it is not the message of this set of surveys, nor is it the message of Aaron's, that politics should be based on just getting to 50% plus one. It's clearly the implied lesson of these surveys that if you want to get adequate support for a united Ireland to achieve losers' consent, a great deal of preparatory work has to be done in the Republic, and a great deal has to be done to assure the potential losers, who include unionists and loyalists, that much will be done to accommodate them so that losing will not mean losing everything. They will not be expropriated. They will have freedom to march in orange parades if that is their wish. They will not have their British citizenship taken away from them. Depending on the model of a united Ireland, there could be a continuing united Ireland. And if not, there will be very adequate proportional representation of Northern interests in a united Ireland parliament. So, in short, I think the majority rule is here to stay. That's legally appropriate, constitutionally entrenched, and just. The question is, how does one build adequate support for unification? And the tone of the question implied that somehow we shouldn't be pandering. I agree, but we shouldn't be pandering on either side. Our surveys show that the project of Irish reunification requires deep strategic thought.
I think Brendan has answered that pretty comprehensively, Pat, but I did notice with some interest, you know, you see these debates continuing on the letters page of our newspaper in the wake of these results, and one letter writer a few days ago was singing the praises of the Opsahl Commission. There have been no shortage of, you know, seminars and commissions and committees over the years looking at these constitutional issues, including well before the Good Friday Agreement. And the Opsahl Commission, which was praised on one day, was attacked on another day because the Opsahl Commission was actually one of those that had recommended that a majority of unionist voters, effectively a unionist veto, should be required before reunification. That was taken off the table, as Brendan says, wasn't it, nearly three decades ago, and it's not coming back.
It's very difficult to see it coming back for many of the reasons that Brendan outlines. I don't think there'd be the political will to do that. That having been said, I think it was Seamus Mallon towards the end of his life used to talk about the idea of parallel consent. And of course, that parallel consent doesn't necessarily have to be given in the ballot box. A loser's consent, as Brendan has outlined in his remarks a few moments ago there, and also in the articles that he did too as part of the series, a loser's consent amongst the unionist community is as necessary to make the project of unification a success. And I suppose, you know, there's two questions, I suppose, about a united Ireland, you know, if that is your desire. One is how to bring it about. But the other much more difficult one, and that's simply a matter of electoral arithmetic, but the other much more difficult one is about how to make it a success. And that will not be done without the consent of at least, you know, a majority and probably a great majority of unionists to the process, to the democratic process, and to extend their losers' consent to it, if that is if that is what happened. There is a related rabbit hole that we probably shouldn't go down, but it's about the reform, the other reforms that might be necessary in the Good Friday Agreement. The structure of Northern society is very different now to what it was in 1998, and it seems to me that if there is an argument for revisiting the provisions of the Good Friday Agreement, then that is where they might start to take account of the third rising force, the neithers, the many of them alliance voters.
Sorry,
and so forth.
Sorry to put a fact check on that, Pat. The proportion of people voting nationalist in the Northern Ireland Assembly election, according to estimates done by John Garry, Jamie Poe and myself, was roughly 42%. And the proportion voting unionist was roughly 42%. The remainder voted other. That is not a huge rise in the others. We should not exaggerate the rise of the others. What is interesting about the others is the consolidation of the Alliance Party as the largest party among the others. And yet that party itself is divided when you examine the preferences of the people who support it. It's divided three ways, between those who don't know about the future, those who are pro-union, who are the larger group, or those who are pro-unification. So we should not, I think, exaggerate or talk about seismic change in the North in terms of the distribution of the blocs.
It's a slow tectonic change, if it's a change at all, is it? Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Right. We're going to move on to another question here, and it comes from Daniel Daly. John, maybe you could take this. Daniel asks, how do we think that attitudes towards reunification would change if Scotland became independent?
Well, I'm sure it would have a big effect. We don't have direct data on this, unfortunately, so we're speculating. But almost certainly, this would be a blow to Britishness, broadly defined, because it would be hard to see what was really Britain anymore if Scotland disappears from Britain. You're left with England and Wales. And given that the identity of many northern Protestants is Britishness, the very concept of that would take a bit of a blow, one might imagine. And one might speculate that there could be a bit of a morphing of identity by such people into perhaps Ulster identity, which used to be at least somewhat prevalent, or Northern Irishness as an identity choice. Without, you know, I suppose there's a couple of reactions that people from a unionist perspective could have if Scotland disappears. It could be, you know, really quite discombobulated and quite upset, and kind of feel that the thing that they're loyal to and feel a part of is crumbling, and their views might harden as a consequence of that against the United Ireland. Or they might take a slightly different view and think, well, I don't know, the thing we belong to is kind of crumbling a bit. Let's have a look south at the border to see how we can shape that. But I'd rather have asked questions on this and be able to report some facts rather than my speculative ramblings.
I have no such concerns, Pat. So I'm going to ask you this, because I mean, I know, and having been, if you find yourself in parts of North Antrim, in everything from culture to accent to religious faith, there is a very, very close tie, much closer tie between many people in those parts of the island and people across the water in parts of Scotland than there is between those people and people in your county of Tipperary, for example. So I think there would be a sense of cultural dislocation, as well as the loss, the deep loss of the symbolism of Britishness, you know, that is connected through Scotland and Northern Ireland. Also, the Ulster Scots identity, you know, there's a reason why it includes the word Scots.
Unusually, I agree with you on this, Hugh, and also I am untroubled by the lack of the lack of data, which worries John, because at least it means that Brendan can't contradict us. But my view is close to yours, Hugh, that it would be a kind of a psychologically destabilizing blow for many people in the unionist community. But I'm also of the view that the hard Brexit pursued by the UK means that an independent Scotland is much, much less likely now, because it would involve the Scots voting for an economic border on the Tweed, and I just don't see that happening. Now, it is possible, I suppose, to look further down the line and look at a Labour government that I think will pursue much closer economic links. I don't think it would rejoin the single market, at least in the medium term, but it would look at much closer economic links with the EU, or at least to remove some of the barriers to trade that the hard Brexit has introduced in the UK. And that could alter the picture, I guess, down the line. But for the immediate future, I think there's no prospect of of Scotland voting for independence.
It has been an attractive notion for some nationalists, Brendan, hasn't it? The idea that reunification would take place, or maybe even be accelerated by the collapse of the United Kingdom as a whole. I sort of agree with Pat that seems less likely than some suggest. I don't know what your thoughts are.
I think it's deeply involved in British party politics. If you think about the Conservative Party, its reputation is over the very long run that it has its ruthless eye on the main chance and on keeping power. It's not displaying that very vividly in the last few years. Indeed, it looks likely to lose government. But imagine that Labour is in charge. It's Labour that is the champion of devolution, not the Conservatives. And it's Labour who strongly want Scotland to remain in the United Kingdom. What happens if the Tories, in effect, become downsizers, if they decide that their best chance of returning to power in the UK is to let Scotland have a referendum? After all, it's the Conservatives who allowed a referendum on the subject in the first place. So we have to allow for that possibility, and we have to allow for the possibility that the Conservatives might just decide that they are the party of English nationalism. The relationship between Scotland and Northern Ireland is complicated, and it's not just Ulster Scots who have those relationships. It's also Northern Gaels and Catholics in the Glens of Antrim. What I would say is this: the Labour Party historically has been more favourable to Irish nationalists than one might otherwise have expected. But on the Scottish question, Labour is unified in wanting to avoid Scotland's secession. And that means that there are messy complexities here. Northern Ireland has a right to unify with the Irish Republic in a referendum every 7 years. Scotland has no right under the UK constitution as presently constituted according to its Supreme Court to vote on the question, even if it has a majority in its parliament in favour of the question. And even if the polls were consistently to show well over 50% plus one in favour of independence. Now, in my view, that's not a stable scenario. The Scots cannot be held at bay forever on the grounds that Westminster decides. You will recall it was part of our history that Home Rule denied for a very long time was the cause of one of the causes of our insurrection in 1916. I'm not predicting the same in Scotland, but it can't be the case that the UK can keep the lid on the Scottish aspiration without a second referendum forever.
That's very interesting. We'll leave that thought there, and we're going to take a break. But just before we do, just to remind you that if you want to read all the data and all the articles and all the analysis, some of it rooted in actual data and some of it by Pat, you would really need a subscription to irishtimes.com. Just go to irishtimes.com/subscribe and sign up there at a very reasonable price. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this. And you're very welcome back. I'm Hugh Linehan, still here with Brendan O'Leary, Pat Leahy and John Geary. We're discussing the North and South project at the Irish Times in association with Aaron's. We have a question in from Thomas Hennehan.
So I just have two questions in relation to the practicalities, I suppose, of a United Ireland in the future if it happens. The first is just education. And is there any indication that we need to be moving a lot faster on divestment of state schools from religious organisations, particularly if we're going to make space for the various communities, both North and South, going forward in an all-island education system? And then just the second is on our blood donation structures. Obviously, the North has their own organisation and the South have ours. And while they work together quite well, I imagine, they obviously have different rules and different policies. And I believe the Northern one is under the NHS, whereas ours isn't under the HSC. Would those have to come together as one formal organisation, align all their rules and policies, or could they continue on two separate footings as two different organisations going forward? Thanks a million.
John, to paraphrase Michael Gove, we've all had enough of bloody experts, but we don't have any blood experts on this particular podcast, so I don't think we'll answer that question. But I think the broader thrust of the question is about these two very large, very complex systems, one that runs the education systems north and south of the border, and the ones that run essentially the health systems. And knitting them together is not an easy task. In fact, very far from it. You know, no matter where you live, you know how complicated those things are at this point.
Yeah, they're very complicated. But despite the complexity, we asked some blunt questions in our survey, which can shed a little bit of light on this. We asked a couple of questions about education and different education systems in our survey. We didn't have space to describe them in any of the articles, but we asked respondents, both North and South, if they'd be more or less likely to vote for United Ireland under certain educational system conditions. And in one of the questions, we said, imagine a United Ireland and it promoted a publicly owned and funded school system that made no religious distinctions between in education. Would that make you more or less likely to vote for United Ireland? And we asked a second question is, imagine there was a United Ireland and schools were funded, including those with a religious ethos. So we basically got respondents to reflect on a secular versus a religious education system. And the most interesting point to come out is that amongst Protestants in Northern Ireland, they were more likely to be at least a little bit favourable towards a united Ireland under the context of an educational system which didn't make any religious distinctions. So there was a greater percentage of them who said, yeah, it might make me a little bit more likely to vote for a united Ireland if it was that particular type of education rather than any other one. I think that's interesting. I'm not entirely certain how to interpret it, but it might be because they would think if in a united Ireland there wasn't any religious distinction in schools, then there wouldn't be any particular religious group dominating the educational system, and therefore if Protestants are in a minority in a united Ireland, they wouldn't be kind of swamped in some way by one, the education system wouldn't be dominated by one thing and they'd be in a minority. So that might be the thing.
I mean, the other point that should be made is that the state education sector, primary and secondary education sector in Northern Ireland, is where most people from a Protestant background go to. You know, there's a divided education system, but the state system is where most Protestant pupils go to, not exclusively, of course.
Yeah, and it would have been nice to have included more questions, because the real divide in Northern Ireland is really, do you go to a grammar school or do you not go to a grammar school? That's the big class divide in Northern Ireland. It's also a division that's quite handy to predict political attitudes. So, for example, if you want to understand why Protestants were in favour of Brexit, well, the ones who went to a grammar school weren't in favour of it. The ones who didn't go to a grammar school were. So it's a political distinguishing. Yeah,
which is similar to numbers that we'd see in the United Kingdom and England and Wales and elsewhere as well. Pat, what do you make of these big questions of fitting these things together?
Well, I suppose a couple of points occur. The first is that they are undoubtedly complex, but the knitting together of administrative systems and systems of administering public services and so forth, it may be complex, but it is not, you know, over a period of time beyond the wit of man, I would have thought. I mean, there's a broader question, I suppose, about the model of a united Ireland that might, were there to be majority support in both jurisdictions, for us, the model that you then might choose. And we sketched out two models that I know Brendan can talk about at length, one being a unitary state and the other being a devolved model, whereby Northern Ireland would continue to exist, but as an entity with devolved power being devolved from Dublin rather than London. And that seems to me might be a way to assuage the anxieties of unionists, at least for an interim period, that, you know, those unionists who fear a united Ireland and what it would mean for exactly those sort of things, like health services is another huge factor for people in the north, which we haven't discussed, but also education. And that those institutions and other institutions of state as currently exist would continue to exist for at least an interim period. I guess that's something that we didn't discuss in any great detail over the course of the series, but it seems to me it's something that might be fruitful for further discussions.
And Brendan, I want to put that to you. And actually, in doing so, I want to actually put another question, which we have audio from. This question is from David Carroll.
Hi, Hugh. David Carroll here. I'm a big fan of the podcast. I'm an Irish Times subscriber, you'll be glad to hear. And I'm a passionate believer in a united Ireland. Despite ongoing failures in areas like health and housing, consistent surveys have shown Irish people to be happy with the state we live in. And we're regularly rated as one of the best places in the world in which to live. I don't believe voters in the South, myself included, will ever have any interest in implementing significant change here in order to accommodate any minority grouping that might want to join our state. So, does the panel accept, therefore, that a united Ireland will only happen when sufficient numbers in the North are happy to join the Southern state as it is, warts and all? And until that time, most voters here will be happy to carry on as we are.
Now, Brendan, David lays out a point of view which seems to command quite strong support, particularly in the South from your data, which is, yes, they'll just become part of Ireland and Ireland will proceed unhindered as it has done hitherto. That seems to me to be a block to progress, if anything.
Thank you, Hugh. If I could go back first to education, and I will promise to return to that, the question you've just posed by David. On education, technically what we were doing was testing people's general disposition towards integrated education or consociational education. In integrated education, the state funds a common system. Everybody goes to the same schools. We can all understand that. In the consociational system, which Ireland has had, north and south, each religious denomination gets equal funding from the state. That wasn't always true in the north, but Protestant schools have been funded in the south persistently since partition and still are. So what we were doing was testing people's favorability towards those general models. And we find a general preference slightly higher for integration. And I think that's interesting. So we weren't directly asking them in this question to compare a United Ireland with no Northern Ireland with a United Ireland in which Northern Ireland persists. And that's point one. We would love to do more detailed work. And I think my friend and colleague, John Garry, has it on the head. The key difference between systems is that the Southern system, broadly speaking, is comprehensive in nature. In consequence, far more people graduate from what Americans call high school in the South at 17 with some important level of qualification. In the North, too many people still qualify without any educational certification or credentials at all. And that's particularly concentrated these days among working class Protestant boys. And that is one of the grave inequalities that needs to be addressed by public policy now and well before unification. And if it is a problem at unification, it too has to be addressed at that juncture. And the easiest way to address that would be through an integrated system. Now, to the question posed by David. Well, actually, under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, the question posed does involve the North joining the South. There is nothing in the Good Friday Agreement that says anything about the formation of a new state. He may be thinking that the changes that some people envisage, including myself, would be ones that would be unwelcome in the South. Changes to the national anthem, changes to the preface to the Constitution, changes to the flag, changes to the way perhaps schooling is run. Maybe all these things are unwelcome to David. But he has to ask himself, if he is in favor of a united Ireland, why he would want to make it more difficult for a united Ireland to occur. And the obvious difficulty for many Northern Protestants is the fear that a united Ireland would involve the extinction of their British identity, their loss of British citizenship, and their loss of a whole series of connections to the British polity, including the Commonwealth. Most of the quotation marks concessions, close quotation marks, that are required of the South, in my view, are minimal if they are properly understood. The Commonwealth is not the British Commonwealth anymore. It's not even clear that the next head of the Commonwealth will be King William III. It's not clear that, well, by 10 years' time, there may be a very, very small number of monarchies left in the Commonwealth. And the Commonwealth offers an opportunity for Irish athletes to win medals at a much greater rate than they might win if they participated in the Olympics. Rejoining the Commonwealth should be a no-brainer. The reason it isn't is that leaving the Commonwealth is associated with our sovereign independence because the British forced us into the Commonwealth at the treaty and denied the possibility of republics being part of the Commonwealth, although they changed their mind once India became independent. So that's an example of a question where, on inspection, the citizens of the South should realize that making a concession here is relatively easy. I grant you that changing the flag and changing the anthem will be more problematic. I don't think changing the preface to the Constitution will be particularly controversial. So there are things that the South can do to make it easier for the potential losers to accept that they will be part of a Republic of Ireland. There's no implication in anything I've said or anything that anybody has suggested that somehow the monarchy would be coming back. 4% of the population of the island are monarchist in some form or another. That's not a big issue. The big issue is, will people like David be willing to make minimal but significant, symbolically significant changes that will make it easier for Ulster Unionists to live contentedly in a united Ireland?
Just to jump in on that, Hugh, if I can, but Brendan, isn't it the case that the data shows, and this, to my mind, is one of the big headline findings of them, is that for an awful lot of people in the Republic, they're not willing to make those concessions. Now, it may be that they change their minds in the future when the debate becomes more intense and more informed and more immediate. But as of now, the sort of united Ireland that many people in the South envisage is not really a united Ireland as such, but more a sort of a nationalist takeover.
Well, I would say technically what they envisage is assimilation, them becoming like us. That's what they want.
Yeah, the West German, East German model.
Right.
And they were all Germans, though.
the important thing is that the model of a united Ireland in the heads of most people in the South is strongly socialized from our history books. It's Irish, it's Catholic, it's Gaelic. And those, even if you don't speak Irish, even if you're no longer a Catholic, having been descended from those groups is what defines you as Irish. And of course, there's a very significant proportion of the North who share that heritage, and that should never be forgotten. But in the case of United Ireland, what makes it different from Germany is accommodating a group with different ethnic origins, different imagined and different real ethnic origins, a different religious background, and a different set of linguistic origins. So much more will have to be done to accommodate difference in a united Ireland than was the case in a united Germany. That's the measure of the task before us. But I do think that though Pat is absolutely right to indicate resistance, I'm not sure we can read off this survey and say that people are completely inflexible on these matters. That has yet to be tested. And in principle, I'd like to do deliberative fora with my friend John Gary just to see how baked in people's preferences are on these questions.
That in relation to those things, John, can I ask you that the kind of issues there which Brendan is discussing, the ones that are symbolic, but symbolism is no less powerful for being symbolism. So flags and anthems and membership of the Commonwealth and various other things, probably change status of the Irish language in a revised constitution and a range of other things. They're one basket of things, and then which are seen as being concessions to create an agreed new Ireland. And then there are other ones which are more, I suppose, structural, and Pat mentioned the idea of retaining Northern Ireland as a political entity within a united Ireland, along with some of the structures of the Good Friday Agreement. Those two sets of things seem quite different to me. Maybe it's because I quite like the idea of the first, and I would be concerned about the idea of the second, given that those structures don't seem to be working very well right now, and I have limited faith in their ability to structure to function better into the future.
Well, I guess the difference is how you suspect that people who don't want a united Ireland might interpret the difference. And they might be impressed by symbolic changes, new anthem, new flag, or they might think that's a bit tokenistic and what we want is meaningful power. Whether that's the maintenance of a devolved united Ireland in the structure, or, for example, changing the manner in which governments form in Dublin in the integrated model to require the involvement of a unionist stroke British party in the coalition with possibly veto powers. So we don't have direct data really from Protestants, the extent to which they would see this as symbolic stuff as perhaps ultimately tokenistic or not. I do think the discussion of David Carroll's question is fascinating, because I strongly suspect it's the same David Carroll who wrote a letter into the Irish Times on Saturday, a couple of sentences of which are fantastic. He says, When the opportunity arises, I would be thrilled to vote for the six counties to join our state. But if that is contingent on us diluting our Irishness or significantly altering the country we have built over the last century, I will regretfully decline and wait until a better proposal is put before us in due course. I suspect I am not alone. Now, I think that's a wonderful statement of the kind of thing Pat and Brendan were just talking about. And it puts the challenge up to advocates of a united Ireland, I think, to navigate this tightrope between, on the one hand, offering a way of having a united Ireland which mitigates the fears of those who don't want to be in it, whether that's through symbolic change, flags and anthems, or meaningful political safeguards with kind of framework or veto powers. All of that on the one hand. And on the other hand, thinking, how many Davids are there out there who are going to be absolutely appalled at this and will kind of either stay at home on the day or won't vote at all? Another way of saying this is, how fragile or not is the 66% support rate in the South that we report for a united Ireland? Brendan, I think, was suggesting it's probably not fragile. It's a big lead, and with a bit of thinking and discussion, people will probably come around to accepting the reasonableness of quote-unquote concessions. But I think it's a bit of a tightrope.
The way I analyse things in my book is consistent with what John has just said. I argue that the model of a united Ireland can't be one in which Southerners don't recognise themselves. They think correctly that the Republic is a success. It's a political success. It's a commercial success. It's not perfect. It has inadequate health provision. It has a housing crisis. It's not a paradise, but it is a remarkable and well-accomplished institutional success. And they're not going to jeopardize that. And for that reason, I think they won't be interested in establishing a federal government that would be vulnerable to veto powers. They'll want to keep a Dáil Éireann in Dublin, where a decisive collective majority will be in charge of foreign policy and key taxation policy. Those things, I think, won't be negotiable. All other things are negotiable, provided that the entity is a recognisable sovereign united Ireland. And the difficulty of statesmanship over the next decade is to try and work out what cultural compromises are feasible and to see if people can be persuaded to accept them.
Of course, it might be said that not all change needs to wait for a vote on unification.
Indeed.
Mark Fegan has a question here.
What are your thoughts on Northern representation in the Oireachtas and or the presidency? And do you believe there's any chance of Sinn Féin or any other party implementing this in the future?
What do you think the chances of that are?
So, given previous intimations from the Supreme Court, there is no issue in Ireland deciding to give its diaspora the vote if it wishes to do so. Ireland is one of four countries in the European Union where those who are non-resident lose their right to vote. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward. In Dáil Éireann elections, the number of citizens abroad could quite easily be pivotal in every single election. That's why most discussion has focused on giving the diaspora the right to vote on the election of the president. What could not be done, I think, is to confine giving the right to vote for the president to Northerners. It would have to extend to all people who have Irish citizenship who are non-resident in the Republic. I don't think that would be particularly controversial. As Pat says, the Taoiseach has the right to nominate 11 senators, and that power has often been used to appoint Northerners. I think that would be uncontroversial for Mary Lou MacDonald to do that. To recompose the Senate, that would, I think, require constitutional amendments, though there may be modifications of the panels that can occur through statutes. But I think much of this is moot, because I think if there is to be a Sinn Féin-led government, it will be a coalition government, and the coalition partners will not be happy with arrangements that look as if they're expanding Sinn Féin voters but not expanding other voters. So I do expect some movement on the question of the election of the presidency. Several parties have committed to that in the past. Whether it will go through is another matter, because there is a genuine demographic and electoral danger of the diaspora deciding the president rather than the domestic population, and that would be comparatively unusual.
With a last question, it's a sort of a nerdy one, but it's a subject close to my heart. It's about being as transparent as possible with data, whether it be in Irish Times opinion polls or on other polls. It was directed to me by an anonymous questioner on Twitter and asked, will the Irish Times release the data tables for the polls? I don't think we hold those data tables. I think it's Aaron's. Is that right?
No, we hold them jointly. And I have a general rule which I rarely break, which is I don't respond to anonymous accounts on Twitter or anywhere else, whether they come online or whether they come through my letterbox with a green biro written on them. But we have said from the word go, the data is held and owned jointly by Aaron's and the Irish Times. We said from the word go that when the series is concluded, that we would make that publicly available. The series is now concluded. We will do that. We just need to sit down and figure out how to do it.
Thanks, Pat. Brendan, you wanted to come in there.
Yes. The intention on the part of Aaron's, of course, is to cooperate with the Irish Times in making all the data publicly available. We intend to have a site at Aaron's, which will be posted on the Royal Irish Academy, where we will have a link to all the published Irish Times articles, and we will supply a Word document with all the basic tables. But for those who care about data in the proper archived manner appropriate for the Academy, we will be deciding where the site will be for those who want to access the data using SPSS software. We have not decided on that location yet.
That's good news, I think, for people who like that kind of thing. And I must say, I like that kind of thing myself. And I do think that that's best practice as well with this kind of research. So I'm very glad to hear that's happening. We will leave it there. Thanks very much indeed to John and to Brendan and to Pat for joining us today. This podcast was produced by Declan Conlon and it was engineered by JJ Vernon. We'll be back. We'll be discussing these issues and many more in weeks and months to come. I have no doubt. I hope to see you all back here again at some point. But until the next time, thanks very much for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.